KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Wednesday, January 21st, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Today's topic will be the Nebraska State Budget. The speakers will be the Governor of Nebraska, the Honorable Mike Johanns, and the Speaker of the Nebraska State Legislature, Kurt Brahm. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Kerr, chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a noon forum on a subject that we think will be of interest to our members and the general public. Our forums here at the Press Club are open to anyone who would like to attend. They can also be heard on KIOS Public Radio. Today we are privileged to have with us Governor of Nebraska Mike Johanns and Speaker of the Legislature Kurt Brahm. The subject, the state budget. The legislature is, as you know, just beginning the 2004 session and is again facing a budget shortfall. You all will remember what happened last session when lawmakers faced a gap in revenue. The governor wanted to make up the difference without any tax increases. Lawmakers decided that's not the right solution and passed a combination of budget cuts and tax increases over the governor's veto. So, what will happen this session in the face of a $211 million budget shortfall? There is paper and pencil on your tables. Please write down your questions. Keep them to the subject at hand, the budget. Somebody will come around and pick up those questions for me to ask at the end of the first half hour. Each of our guests will speak for 10 to 15 minutes, and then I'll ask as many of the questions as we have time for. So, Governor Johanns, we will begin with you.
You know, every once in a while I watch the legislature in session, and oftentimes somebody will get up to speak, and really what they're doing is kind of laying the groundwork for someone else to say something. So they'll just get up and say, "I defer," you know. And so, Kurt, it's probably not fair if I just got up and deferred every... It is great to be back at the Omaha Press Club. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I'm going to talk to you a little bit today about the budget, of course, but I'd also like to maybe touch base with you on some of the things that you've read about over the past few days relative to the five areas of reform that I spent really 90% of the state of the state on. I'm certain that you probably arrived here today hoping for a great controversy, a juicy story about the legislative branch and the executive branch being at war over the budget, and here we go again. Quite honestly, this year nothing could be further from the truth. The budget, although we certainly have our work cut out for us, so far there's been general consensus about the approach and how we deal with the budget, and it appears to me that that consensus is probably going to move through the Appropriations Committee right onto the floor of the unicameral. This is a little different session than last time. The economy is improving. We're seeing a better economy. Doesn't mean that I'm going to suggest to you that every month we end up with money beyond the projections. I don't think that's going to happen at all. But I just think there's a better agreement as to how we approach this and how we deal with the budget issues. The other thing I will tell you is after a very, very difficult session last year, and in my state of the state, I kind of referred to it this way, pick your poison. Raise taxes, that's not very popular. Cut programs, that's not very popular. Pick your poison. That's what the last session was all about. I don't care where you headed. In this state or any other state in the United States, there was not going to be a warm reception in what you proposed because literally there just was not enough money to go around. And in this state, we don't buy a lot of $1,500 toilet seats or hammers. We're pretty conservative people. Even our liberals are pretty conservative, and consequently the investments we make tend to make a difference in the lives of citizens. And so when you propose cutting that, needless to say, it's a very frustrating thing. We started out this year with about a $211 million gap. What do I mean by that? It's often referred to as a deficit. It is not a deficit in the clearest sense of the word. Deficit implies that we've already spent the money. There's a huge gap, and if we don't fix the gap, then we shut down state government. That's not the case at all. What it is, very simply, is the money that was projected to arrive when the budget was built over the next 2 years is not coming in at the pace that was anticipated, to the tune of about $211 million. We are about halfway through the first year of that budget cycle, so there's about a year and a half left in that 2 years. So the money we're talking about is over that 2 years. And then, in addition, I said to the legislature in my state of the state, and the senator who heads up appropriations, Roger Werbein, agreed with this. I said, you know, if you look at this, what we really should be doing is building a plan that not only has merit for today but works over the next 3 years. In other words, we should start thinking about how do we address the budget this year, but then in the next biennial budget, which we will be working on when they come back a year from now for the legislative session in 2005. So the plan that we worked on, the plan that we invited Senator Werbein and the fiscal office to take a look at before he even released, really had that idea in mind, that we would try to deal with these issues over a three-year period of time. And over that three-year period of time, not only does it balance, but it does some other things that I think make a lot of sense. Number one, when the legislature left last year, they set a target for the cash reserve. We honored that target. We said we are going to try to put together a budget plan that basically keeps that rainy day money set aside as the legislature hoped when they passed the budget plan last year, as indicated over my veto. We then also looked out there and said, you know, the hard thing about the last few years in any state in the country is to try to figure out how much money truly will arrive. The projections just haven't been that good. And it's not a Nebraska problem, it's a national problem. Every state is dealing with this. Part of the problem over the last couple of years is I don't think anyone would have projected the dip would be that deep. Now the question is, how significant is the recovery going to be, and how quickly might that help state revenues? So the proposal I made is let's be conservative with that, and as we start planning for that next two-year budget cycle, which again we'll be working on a year from now, let's set aside a 4% reserve in addition to that rainy day fund. Typically, we set aside 3%. But kind of in our way of trying to deal with the unevenness of the projections, I said, let's set that at 4%. Again, that was meant with, I think, general approval. I think many people who have looked at that in the legislature have said, yeah, you know, all things being equal, that makes sense. So where does the budget process go from here? Well, I get first shot. I've got a proposal out there, but now it goes to the Appropriations Committee. They will hold hearings over a period of weeks. They'll look at my recommendations. They'll look at what they learned from the hearing process, and then they'll fashion a proposal that will be sent to the legislative floor. I'll just guess, be bold enough to guess, that there'll be tremendous similarity between what I proposed and what they've arrived at. Will there be some changing? Yes. That's kind of the prerogative of the legislative process. Do I anticipate wholesale across the board sales and income tax increases or expansion of the base this year? I do not. I don't think any senator came back with a notion that that was the way to craft this. And so my anticipation is that that's probably very unlikely to occur. The legislature will then debate the proposal. The closer it is in terms of consensus between the executive branch and the legislative branch, the more likely is that it moves through the process pretty quickly in terms of changes or amendments that may occur on the legislative floor. If it all works right, somewhere in the time frame of April 1, thereabouts, a final package should be agreed upon by the legislature and sent to my desk, where I have an opportunity to line out and veto if I choose to. I can sign the whole package, I can line out it, and then it goes back to them. And if I have exercised any line out and vetoes, they have the opportunity then to debate it and make decisions about what they want to overrule or not. So that's kind of the budget package. That's kind of where we're at. Now, if I might just mention the five areas, and there's not enough time for me to go into this in great detail, but there were five areas I asked the legislature to focus on in terms of reform. I will start out today the same way I started this piece of my State of the State, with giving credit where credit is due. Credit is due here with the gentleman that's with me, Kurt Brown. During this very, very difficult budget session, Kurt said to the legislature and got language put into the budget plan that said, in essence, we need to reform how we are doing business in this state. Now, oftentimes that kind of flowery language gets lip service. Not much happens. A lot happened, as I detailed as I was talking through the State of the State. But in addition, in the off-season, if you will, Kurt brought the legislature together. We participated in that from the executive branch in terms of what areas we were going to be focused on. Well, the upshoot of that is there was a tremendous reform initiative, therefore, brought to the legislature this year. First area is mental health reform. I could give you an hour speech on mental health reform. Let me, if I might, explain the dynamics, though, of what we're dealing with. We are proposing to close two regional centers, one in Norfolk, one in Hastings. I will be the first to acknowledge that is not popular in those communities. Why did we come to that proposal? And I emphasize we, Senator Jim Jensen from the Omaha area, and I have been working on this with others over the last 6 to 7 months. If you put the Norfolk and Regional Center together, we have 250 slots for mental health services thereabouts. That can vary a little bit, but it's about 250 places for individuals who need that kind of mental health service. In terms of state general fund money, we spend $25 million for those 250 slots. In addition, because it's a regional center, Medicaid will pay nothing for those services. Even if it's a Medicaid-eligible person, once they're committed to a regional center, Medicaid excludes any dollars for that. And that's about $9 million a year that we estimate we walk away from. So the true cost of that facility for those 250 slots, state dollars and lost federal dollars, is about $35 million. Our proposal is not less service. I'm not proposing to grab that money and put it into the budget. We didn't put $1 into the budget to balance the budget. What we did say is let's access that federal money. Let's access the money that we are investing in those regional centers, and let's get it out into the community. Now, lest you walk away with the wrong impression, let me explain to you what you would see when you drive on the Norfolk grounds. You would see eight buildings boarded up. Boarded up. Plywood on the windows and doors. You would see one building that's devoted to mental health services. That's what we are calling a regional center. There's three other buildings used, but one building devoted to that mental health service. Hastings is just a tad bit better. Hastings' newest building was built in the 1950s. Until recently, that multi-story building did not have an elevator. Why aren't we putting more money there? Because the economics doesn't make any sense. We can't access Medicaid, even for Medicaid-eligible people there. We are saying, get that money out. Let's provide the services as close to home as we can. It's about better treatment for the families. The second area you've read a lot about over the last few months, is the reform the child protective system in Nebraska. We put together a comprehensive proposal to not only do the things, a lot of the things that the task force recommended, but in addition a way of funding that. So that's the second area. The third area is K through 12 funding. We have endorsed a proposal that was actually part of the last legislative session, but we've also invited school districts to come to the table to help us work on reform in this area. The fourth area is to reform the state's water policy. We have some great recommendations before the legislature. We've put some funding behind that. Water's our future. Without water, you don't have agriculture in our state. And then the other area that is just as controversial as all of them is to reform a piece of constitutional provision called Initiative 300, which prevents corporate operations from engaging in farming operations. We're not necessarily in love with the idea of corporations, but here's the thought. That has had unintended consequences. Unrelated farmers can't join forces and farm together, bring their kids in together, feed livestock together in a corporate structure. It's prohibited by Initiative 300. A neighbor seeking to retire can't bring the neighbor kid in who wants to farm a ranch who is unrelated in a corporate structure and protect his own assets because of Initiative 300. We should not be doing anything to discourage farming operations in the state of Nebraska that bring young people in. So we've asked for a group to look at that and make suggestions in the next legislative session as to how to deal with that. With that now, Mr. Speaker, I do defer to you. It's your turn.
Thank you very much. I want to make note again that there is paper and pencil on your tables. And if you've written down questions, somebody will come around now and pick them up. So, Speaker of the Legislature, Kurt Brahm for the legislative perspective.
Thank you, Gary. Just want you to know, Governor, while you were speaking, I was listening intently, and I ate your food and mine, too. But hopefully they'll bring you some more. I thank you for asking me to come here with the governor. It's an honor and a privilege. It really is. I've served as a speaker since the first special session in 2002 when my friend Doug Christensen left to become president of the University of Nebraska at Kearney. And I was elected speaker at 10 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock we were into trying to solve the deficit problem. And so it was an interesting beginning, but it has been an honor to head the legislature, and I'm not going to spend time on that, but I want to tell you that we have a fairly good system of government. It's frustrating for all of us, whether it be taxpayers or those who depend upon taxes for their programs in times like this, but the process works. And I've come to know some of the speakers in other states, and I've just come home whenever I talk with them and counted my blessings because we get the agenda done, what has to be done. We will get a budget done. We won't leave unless it's balanced, and some states can't say that. And some of you might have heard me tell this story. I'll be brief, but it's true, and it makes a point, I think. When someone rises to the level of being a governor, or in my case, which is speaker, we have to be careful that we don't get too enamored with ourselves in those positions because we are here temporarily serving the people, and hopefully someone even better will follow. But right after I was elected speaker, and I live in the small town of Wahoo, and I practice law there and have my family there, and I'm across the street at the bakery, and this gentleman I've known for years, Adolf, he says, "Hey, Brahm," he says, "I read in the paper you elected talker down there." He says, that's really good." I said, "Well, thanks, Adolf. I'm glad you noticed that." I said, "They call it speaker there, but that's okay." And he said, "Well, how many people come to your funeral is still going to depend upon the weather." So he had an absolute correct point. We started with the slide in 01 and 02 in revenues. It continued in 03 to where last session, as the governor mentioned, we were coming in, and as Gary Kerr mentioned, with over a $700 million problem last session. Tough deal. And we really fought through that. Lots of proposals, lots of hearings, lots of meetings with the governor. And through all of that, we never stopped talking and trying to find common ground. We really didn't. But when the dust settled, the legislature felt that we had to make about $400 million or close to that in reductions, and that we had to make about 300 plus million adjustments in revenue. So we balanced and we went home. And in fact, we overfunded the cash reserve to some extent. We got a little federal money, which we were not expecting, and we put that into the cash reserve. We, instead of the minimum 3% cash reserve, we slightly overfunded that, not knowing what the next months were going to bring. As we come back into this session, people sympathize with me and they say, well, here you've done that last year and you did it the special sessions before that. Here you are $200 million short again. Don't you just hate to go back there? I said, you know what? I think we can work with this. We, and I don't just mean the legislature, the governor and the legislature, I think have gotten us in a position right now where we can handle this kind of shortfall if we don't have another disaster or another unforeseen calamity. We can handle it through some of the adjustments the governor mentioned in his State of the State address that he mentioned here today. There also are some other things that the legislature may choose to do. But it's a number with the cash reserve that we have provided ourselves with that we have a chance to work with without upsetting a great number of programs, without, I think, doing a disservice to education and cutting off necessary funding for education. I think we can provide the essential services for protection, safety, and corrections and still get this thing handled. I think that the governor's proposal makes sense in several ways because he proposes to get us balanced over the next 3 years. We're over halfway through this year, first year of the biennium. We've only got a year to go after that, and to try to balance it all in that period of time would be tough. But by adding another year to the to the forecast, we have a chance, I think, to balance. The governor mentioned the legislative structural reform effort. It's called the 407 effort, and I am very grateful to my colleagues for working very hard on that through the summer, and I think we accomplished a few things. There's a couple things I want to mention that stand out in the budget, and these are simply things that might not be apparent to the average observer. One of the reasons that I proposed that 407 effort to look at structure was that several years in a row we were in structural imbalance in the state. And by that I mean forget about the cash reserve, just look at the money coming in and the money going out. Revenue and expenses. We were structural imbalance. So that doesn't work over a period of time. And so we said, you know, we've got to change that trend next year, the year after, we've got to achieve a structural balance in terms of money coming in and money going out. We're not a California or any place like that where we can incur debt, float bonds, and solve the problem. So I want to tell you that the year we're in right now, which is a fiscal year of 03-04 ending July 1, even with the revised forecast in October that we had that lowered the revenue projections, we still have a structural balance of about $32 million that is projected. If it doesn't get any better, we're still in structural balance. The year after that, 04, 05, if we leave the projections as they are right now, we'll have a structural surplus or balance of $46 million. So that is headed the right direction. And if the economy continues to respond favorably, I think we'll be in pretty good shape. Now, there are some time bombs out there that the governor has acknowledged and that can come upon us, like some of the events that have happened the last couple of years on a national scale, perhaps, or like the mad cow problem, which is a real problem for Nebraska. But some of these that are out there include the low-level waste lawsuit, which is a $150 million-plus problem if we aren't successful on the appeal that's pending. That could come to a head at some point during the next couple of years, and if we're not successful, that's a problem. We have school finance lawsuits out there, which most of you know about, have read about, heard about, and if a school finance lawsuit would be successful and find that we are not providing enough money for K-12 education in some fashion, that's a big problem, because that's a huge part of our budget right now, and we've been attempting. We started several years ago trying to rely more upon sales and income tax and less upon property tax, and we got that lawsuit pending. Missouri River litigation could be a problem for us, not as large as the first two I mentioned. Judges' retirement, some of the judges have filed a lawsuit saying that we can't require them to contribute more to their retirement, and if we can't, that means more state dollars. There's a little known creek out in western Nebraska called Pumpkin Creek, and Pumpkin Creek could cause us huge problems financially. Now, that's not on the radar screen to a great extent. I was on the Natural Resources Committee for years before I was Speaker, and I know about the situation. And what has happened is there have been a couple of lawsuits filed out there that say that the state is partially responsible for drying up Pumpkin Creek due to our water policies, and people who have water rights going back to the 1800s have no water to use for irrigation. So they have a tort claim, and if they're successful, that could precipitate other claims in the state that we're in right now with the drought, that it could be a problem for the state. Those are out there. There's one more thing. The budget balancing situation is predicated upon a growth in revenue. Now, these assumptions are made by people a whole lot smarter than I am, but the assumptions are that we're going to have revenue growth the next couple of years, and that revenue growth is going to exceed 6% based on those assumptions. So if that doesn't happen, we have some problems. So those are the caveats, if you will. And, Gary, I don't want to take any more time. I think we'll stop and go to questions. Again, thank you for letting us be a part of this. It's a great opportunity to visit with you. Thank you.
Senator Kurt Brown, Speaker of the Legislature, thank you very much. And, again, I will remind you that there are pieces of paper, pencils on your table, so if you have more questions, please write them down, and we'll have somebody come around and pick them up. We've got several questions here with regard to the University of Nebraska system. I'm going to ask these all at once, and you folks can respond to them. The University of Nebraska system has had its budget cut $50 million over the past 2 years. Governor, you are proposing another $4 million cut this time. Some people believe that you've got your priorities wrong with such a heavy hit on the university system. Some other questions along the same line. How do you see NU as an agent of stopping the brain drain? And now here's a different take. What recommendations do you have for more efficient use of higher education dollars? Governor?
Boy, try to remember where where I should start here. And I'll let the speaker jump in, too, after I offer a couple of thoughts. First thought I would offer is that this just exemplifies the very problems you deal with when I said pick your poison. It doesn't matter raise taxes, cut programs, neither one is a popular approach. And the important thing is to start out with, whether it's the Speaker or the Governor, we have no choice. Budget must balance. We don't have deficit spending ability, and we don't borrow money in this state. You know, if you're having a tough month at home, maybe you pay the minimum on the credit card, and you go to the next month and hope things get better. We don't have a credit card. We pay as you go, and if there isn't enough money, then you have to spread it around thinner. The university dealt with the budget issues in a number of different ways. Again, probably none that are going to get unanimous acclaim. Tuition increases, seen those all over the country. You saw those in Nebraska, where they tried to deal with the deficit by doing some of those things. They looked at programs. They looked at a number of different things to try to balance. The $4 million this year that the question references is 1%. It's 1% of their total general fund budget. So I don't know who asked the question, but it implies that, by golly, maybe we can't deal with 1%. I'll give you a comparison, and this isn't this probably is not explaining how good things are at all, but it's the reality. All state agencies have started out, I think, with a 4% cut, then a 5% cut, then a 10% cut, and this time they're scheduled for 2.5% cut. We have state agencies that have dramatically had to reduce what they are doing just simply because we took the full brunt of the cut. The legislature's kind of always adopted the attitude, Governor, if you think you can run state government with those kinds of cuts, show us how you're going to do it and have at it. So I guess in the grand scheme of things, no one would like to cut these programs, but in the end, maybe the treatment that they received comparatively maybe wasn't as bad as at least as some state agencies have had to deal with. Brain drain, you know, the whole key here to brain drain is not only the educational opportunities we provide, and there's some outstanding educational opportunities, everything from community colleges to our state college system to our university system. I think we really do have an outstanding higher education system. Key for us is to create jobs. The key for us is to take that young person once educated and give them the opportunity to realize their full potential in our state. And we hope that exists throughout the state. And that's why I, at least, have been such a tremendous proponent for the incentive programs. Controversial in and of themselves, but the reality is when a company like Union Pacific says, you know what, we're not sending jobs out of Nebraska, we're bringing them in from Missouri to Nebraska. Wow. And you know what kind of job that is? That's a high-tech job. That's a $70,000 a year job. Plus, they're hiring people across the state for engineers and other employment. And there's no bad job in Union Pacific. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I believe we need to be focused on and encourage the development. Last thought, economies ebb and flow. If you were governor in the 1990s, you had the wonderful situation of increasing spending. Spending increased 15.5% the year before I arrived, 15.5%. And at the same time, you had the wonderful news that you could cut taxes. Now, I would argue now that hindsight has told us that maybe we should have done less spending and all of that. But the reality is we will have a better economy. We're seeing improvement. And I think it's everybody's hope and dream that we can continue then to advance the things that we believe in, including higher education.
Senator Brown, your thoughts?
I'm a graduate of the University of Nebraska, as is my wife, and I also have my law degree from there, and I have a lot of loyalty to the institution, and I believe in it as a major factor in the economic drive of this state. Now, I also believe that we have a tremendous number of good educational facilities, including our state college system and our community college system, which are providing some great opportunities as well. And that helps cushion the blow a little bit, and I think what this kind of thing does, $4 million is 1%, it isn't the end of the world, but that kind of thing and what we've done with the university the last couple of years requires them to prioritize what they're going to do and where they're going to do it, where they can fill the need the best, and I think that needs to happen. And maybe 5 years from now we might look back, and the university might even look back and say, gee, maybe it's a good thing that we had a little pressure because we're doing an excellent job in those areas that we need to be in, and these other areas are better served by community colleges, by state colleges. So I'm not convinced that that the 1% reduction is going to cripple the mission at the University of Nebraska. If I did, I wouldn't be able to vote for it. And I think a lot of my colleagues feel that way. It'll still be an educational process the next month or month and a half to evaluate the impact of that reduction, but I don't think it's one that's going to be crippling or unreasonable.
A couple of questions along the same lines here, Governor. What is structural balance? That's the first question. The second is, where will the 6% growth in revenue come from? What sectors? Construction, farming, new arenas, mm-hmm. new areas, rather?
Structural balance. When I was teaching my kids how to use a checkbook, I always used to say there's very simple advice here. When you get to zero, stop. and preferably long before that. That's what we're talking about, is that the expenditures equal the income. And that's structural balance. It's the whole idea that the budget has to be in balance as you move year through year. Now, that can be easier said than done, because you put a plan in place for 24 months, and it's like trying to predict how many refrigerators will you buy between now and 24 months from now. How many times will you go to the clothing store? What's your income going to be 24 months from now? And, you know, you're kind of looking at me and saying, Governor, how would I know something like that? I'm hoping for a big raise. What if I don't get it? Well, that's what we're dealing with times a million, you know. It's all those individual decisions out there that can cause the structural balance or imbalance, plus you overlay that with a national economy that if it tanks like we saw after 2001, and it was headed that way months before that, it just really lays down on state budgets very dramatically. How many people will be working? Who will get laid off? What jobs will get laid off? All of those things are things we're trying to figure out in this case 36 months out, because I've talked about a three-year plan. That's structural balance. The other piece of this was, tell me again, Gary.
Let me ask you, find it myself. Where will the 6% growth come from?
That's the very reason why I have recommended that as we look at those final 2 years of this three-year plan, that we build in extra reserve. Instead of 3% planning, we do 4%, because I think that's optimistic. Now, again, your response to that probably is, okay, what's a better figure? That's, again, that whole debate of where is the economy going to be charged from and where's the income going to come from. We have two main sources of income, sales tax and income tax, period. A little bit miscellaneous tax, not so much in corporate tax. The vast, vast majority of our budget, 90%, is built upon individual choices and income and decisions. And I believe that that's optimistic, and so that's why we have tried to work with the legislature to build in a 4% piece in that out 2 years in our planning. So if we don't realize that 6 point whatever percent, We have a fudge factor in there to try to deal with that.
Senator Brown?
Well, he answered, I think, correctly the structural imbalance question, so I won't repeat that. The revenue growth, I'm optimistic about the base industry in this state, and that's agriculture. Unless the export problem doesn't get solved, and we have further ripples from that, so we can't export our beef, that would be an ongoing problem with job loss and so on and so forth. But if that gets solved reasonably well, it seems to me that prices in that sector are looking a little better. With respect to the rest of our economy, I think we have a fairly strong outlook for business right now. The third leg, which is simply jobs, even though I have some concerns about that, I'm encouraged by what I see happening with respect to companies that have been in the news lately, including Union Pacific. I'm also aware of some others that are saying they're going to add some jobs in the very near future. All in all, it looks like a little better situation. Now, we also have a lot of folks in this state that depend upon interest income. And I don't think interest is going to be lower than we've seen it the last year or two, and it may inch up a little bit. And that will also help from the standpoint of income for folks that are able to have some savings. So whether that's going to be the 6% or not, I don't know, Gary, but I certainly hope so.
Question regarding school financing. There is a great deal of discussion about consolidation among small schools. What about among larger districts? I live in Sarpy County, and I strongly believe we have too many districts. Your response, Governor?
You know, as I've talked about this whole issue of how many school districts are the appropriate number for our state, one of the things I've pointed out is this is as much an eastern Nebraska phenomenon as a western Nebraska phenomenon. I think we all kind of walk around with this notion, gosh, if the governor would just go out and close the one-room schools out there that are literally on every mile, then we got school consolidation. That's not the case. And quite honestly, many districts out there have consolidated, and there's a point at which you don't want to put a six-year-old on a bus an hour and a half each way to school. You've just done as much as you can. The population is spread out. But as you get on the eastern part of the state, let me give you an example. I just met with a group this morning on this issue. I'll pick the county that I live in, Lancaster County. My kids went to the educational system there. My daughter graduated from the public high school there. And I'll tell you, I think it's a good school system. I think it's equivalent to probably any public school system in the country. Now, we have a lot of Class 1 districts out there, K through 6, operating. And again, I think maybe you'd walk around thinking, well, gosh, those are a western Nebraska phenomena. That's that one-room schoolhouse that I have in my mind. We have a couple of those within the three-mile limit of the city of Lincoln, operating out there, doing whatever they're doing. It's kind of like a meeting I had soon after becoming governor with a group of business people here, and they said, Governor, too dang much government, way too much government. You've got to lead the charge. You know, fewer this, fewer that, fewer school districts, fewer counties. And this one gentleman, whose name I won't mention, was sitting there, and he said, the only thing I want to tell you, Governor, don't you dare go near District 66. I live in that district. I bought a house in that district because I want my kids to go to school in that district. I pay higher property taxes for living there, and I'm happy to do it. I'm thrilled to do it, as a matter of fact. Don't touch that district. That's the way everybody feels about their school district, you see. I don't care if it's a school of 15 students or it's District 66. They're passionate about that. The reality is, however, somehow, some way, as a state, we've got to come to grips with the cost of financing the structure out there. That's why the proposal is out there, and it's a pretty thoughtful proposal by Senator Rakes that basically says over a period of time here, the Class 1s, K through 6, have to join up with a K through 12 system. But the other interesting thing about this is he said, look, once that is done, we're going to let the local school board make the decision about where the schools are going to be. So if you want to keep all those schools open, great, that's a local decision. And that's an interesting compromise here, and I can't say that it's getting huge support because, again, people worry about this, but I have to tell you, we have to thoughtfully think through those things as a state because there is a cost in maintaining all that structure.
Senator Brown?
I was on the school board for 10 years before I went in the legislature, and I understand the challenges there. Five kids went through public and private school. You get kicked out of one, go to the other, get kicked out of that one, go back to the other one. Just kidding. But I did have kids go to both types of schools, and so I understand that. The governor has not been inaccurate in what he has described as a situation. In western Nebraska, it's not practical to close some of those schools. In eastern Nebraska, it is practical. But is also, we are so ingrained in local control when it comes to our K-12 education that it really must be a local decision. Several years ago, the legislature did pass a bill before I was there to promote consolidation. It was promptly repealed by the people on a referendum vote. And people haven't forgotten that yet today. So we're going to do, I think, everything we can to encourage, to in some cases incent, with our share of the cost from the state, people being as efficient as possible. But I don't see us taking a map, drawing square lines, and saying this will be a district and this will be a district. What Senator Rakes is proposing is one step. Some say it'll save us $4 million on state side a year. It's hard to say until it happens, but I think he's got he's taking a good first step, and we just need to continue to encourage districts to be as efficient. We've got 45% of the money now being furnished by the state. It used to be all almost 100% local dollars, but now it's almost half state dollars. So we have an interest in that, and but I don't see us drawing lines in Omaha and redoing the districts at this point in time.
A couple of questions with regard to LB 775, which is budget-related. Both of these for you, Governor. Why should 775 be operated under such secrecy? Why not be open about amount of dollars given to corporations? The second part of that, it says, recently on statewide TV, you said the repeal of 775 should result in the loss, would result in the loss of jobs. Since you are privy to corporation tax credits, new jobs created, old jobs eliminated. How does this revenue offset the budget deficit and unemployment?
Okay. Great questions today. 775, let me start with the disclosure piece of it. We put in a bill last year to enhance the disclosure, and I tend to be a proponent for that. It's a tough area. It'd be kind of like me standing at the door and saying, you know, if you're on any kind of government program, I need to see your tax return, and you won't mind if I show it to the public, will you? Well, of course you say, wait a second here, you're kidding me. You're going to show my tax return? That, you know, that's pretty protected information, and that kind of confidentiality is where the tension is on disclosure. But again, I tend to be a one who says let's continue to push this envelope because disclosure makes sense to me. If we believe in the program, we should be able to get as much information as possible to show people that the program is a difference maker. Now the question of and I think the second part really gets, you know, why do it? First thing that's really important to understand, we don't have to. We don't. There's no constitutional requirement that we do any kind of incentive program. We can just simply say, look, we don't believe in it. Let's repeal it. And I think that petition drive that's out there by Nebraskans for Peace really is trying to get to that issue. The dynamic of that is a very heavy-duty policy question. Let me give you an example. If you are a rural person, I think every ethanol plant except one has those credits in it. We tend to think it's here in Omaha. It's not. If you work at Beck and Dickinson in Broken Bow, the credit program worked there. That's why those jobs and expansion occurred. Same way with Beck and Dickinson and Holdridge. The other thing I say to my rural friends and supporters is this. Tax policy is that fine-tuned balance between encouraging economic growth and paying for the services that we want, caring for our seniors, educating our children, all of those things. If I go out and buy a new car today, I will pay a sales tax on that, and it will go to help fund the roads, and a small piece of it, as of recently, will go to help fund the general fund, the educational programs, the programs for Medicaid, etc. If I buy a new tractor, I don't pay sales tax. Now, you may look at that and say, Mike, what? You don't pay sales tax if you buy farm equipment in this state? Why is that? Because a very important policy choice was made here. Are we giving up some income there? Yes, of course we are. It's obvious. We don't collect the sales tax on farm equipment. But you know what? I don't want that farmer to go to Kansas to buy his equipment either. I want that industry alive and well in this state. And so I support that. I would aggressively fight any attempt to deal with that differently because, again, this is a competitive business. Now, could we tax that? Yes, of course we could tax it. Could we tax a lot of things? Yes, of course we could tax a lot of things. But again, it is that fine-tuned balance in process, in decision-making that encourages growth in our economy. And believe me, there is strong evidence that 775 has created jobs, encouraged growth, and we have better employed people in this state because of that. And I can take you to those areas. Be very careful about this policy debate because it may be tempting to say, well, let's just, you know, make it go away. You'll pay a price statewide for that, and you have to decide whether it's a price you want to pay because you'll have to get used to your governor or your mayor saying those jobs are in Council Bluffs because we can't compete. Iowa would love to have everything we don't want. They would. And Tom Vilsack would love to come over here. And I don't blame him. I was over in his state recently trying to get some jobs over here. So it's just, it's a very, very competitive business. Very competitive.
Speaker Brown?
I think 775 in my legislative district's probably about as controversial as it is anywhere. And I have always supported the concept of 775. I do feel that we do need to acknowledge that we need to do a better job of disclosing to the public what the benefits of 775 are and the costs of 775. The taxpayer, the public, deserves to know that, and I think that will happen. And I hope that it happens soon enough that people don't lose confidence in the program. When people don't really know what's going on, there's a lot of suspicion that surrounds darkness and non-disclosure. And I don't want to disclose anybody's tax return, but I think there are ways to disclose what the costs and the benefits are and what they are with respect to particular areas of industry. I also think that there's a need to, after 15 years, to fine-tune 775 and tailor the program a little bit more to jobs. And in some cases, the companies that are growing more recently are those that have pretty high-paying jobs, but in some cases they don't have a terrific capital investment. It may be a high-tech type job. It may be related to technology, but there are some good jobs that we can attract. We need to tailor that program or another program to attract those kinds of jobs. So we've got some work to do on public relations. I think there will be some of that occur in the very near future. I know there's a study that's going to be done that should be done by the end of February that will help us analyze the value of 775. And hopefully the legislature will stay on target and not remove this incentive. I don't think we will. I just hope the people don't get too frustrated in the process. And also what's brought the questions on is the economy the last couple of years. And we received a lot of pressure in the legislature. You know, if we're going to make cuts, let's cut that program. Let's go in there and somehow or other, let's take $50 million out of that. Well, for one thing, to me, that's infrastructure. That's like saying, okay, we have a bad economy right now. We're going to quit building roads. We're going to quit repairing roads and some of those types of, or we're going to quit expanding our utility base so that we can enhance utilities for people. That is such a basic part of our infrastructure that it will have negative effects years down the road if we step back from those things during tough times. So that's I think that's all I have to say, Gary. Thanks.
Senator Brown, the governor wants to close two state hospitals. He talked about that as part of his mental health reform proposals. Do you really think that that can happen? Will your colleagues go along with that?
It's it is too soon for me to predict the outcome of that, Gary. The bill has just been introduced. It is I'm not sure what the hearing date is, so I don't know how my colleagues feel exactly. I do know that there's a lot of support for reform, restructure in the mental health area. As a former county attorney, I know what it's like to have somebody who is arrested who is obviously mentally ill and try to make calls to find a place to put them, not have a place to take them, and put them in your jail, which is ill-equipped for that, and risk injury to that person, doing danger to themselves or damage to themselves, and that's a terrible frustration. The mental health system needs reform. Now, whether that reform means that we need to close both those institutions and when we need to close them, I don't know yet. But we all agree on one thing. We can do a better job in mental health, and we're going to try to do that.
Governor, are you in a predicting mood? Are you going to get this through?
I guess I'm optimistic that we can marshal the forces. Is there an opportunity to work with the legislature and both communities, Hastings and North Fork? Absolutely. As I gave an interview yesterday and I said, you know, if I was the mayor of Hastings or North Fork, I'd be heading to the legislature and saying we want to be the hub of regional, of this region for community-based care, because we can do mental health services. And I would do everything I could to be a 16-bed facility or less, because that's what qualifies for Medicaid. I would do everything I could to build community-based services that would serve that area of the state. And there is a place for these communities that is that does the things we hope to get done. This is as tough as it gets. Cutting the number of school districts in half, Kurt, would be tougher, but this is not popular in Hastings and North Fork, and they're, of course, making their views known. So we'll see. I think the spirit of reform is good, and my hope is that we can move the agenda that the speaker announced so many months ago to reform some key areas of service, including this one. But I do we have 25 votes today or 33 if we need to shut off debate? I don't think anybody has that kind of accurate count. It's just too much in the state of flux today.
Well, we're coming to the end here, and we always try to end with a light question at the end. So I'll get both of you to respond to this. You both talked of cooperation on the budget. But if arm wrestling is needed at the end to make this all happen, which of you is in the best position to win that?
Well, I'm working out every day, so I...
You know, one of the things I've enjoyed about being speaker, the governor and I meet weekly, sometimes just to squelch any rumors or misunderstandings between our respective branches, and sometimes we just sit there and agree on what a fine kettle of fish we have now or whatever. But we've had no problem communicating, and that will continue. And arm wrestling, I will win.
All right. Well, remember that. Listen to both of you. Thank you very much, Governor Johans and Speaker Brown. One last note here before everybody leaves. Our Press Club Noon forums are available via the Internet or by purchasing a videotape copy from CP Media. To do that, you can call 800-227-5281. If you can't remember that, call the Press Club. We've got it here. Again, many thanks to our speakers here today, to our audience at the Press Club and our KIOS radio audience, and we are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's topic was the Nebraska State Budget. The speakers were the Governor of Nebraska, the Honorable Mike Johans, and the Speaker of the Nebraska State Legislature, Kurt Brahm. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Wednesday, January 21st, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Thursday, February 19th at 12 noon. The speaker will be Tim Higgins, Senior Director of Client Services with the Gallup Corporation. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.